Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Monday, March 9th, and we're going to have a lecture on autonomic nervous system today. And next time, no lecture. It's a holiday for me. But don't forget, you got to come to class because there's a test. There's the second test on Wednesday, right? So does everybody know? I forgot what chapters are on it. Well, let's see. 4, 5, and 7. Does that sound right? 4, 5, and 7. Enzymes, easy chapter. Respiration, a little bit harder. Neurophysiology, maybe a little bit harder still. All right. So make sure you know how to label all those diagrams backwards and forwards. Make sure you have in your mind gluconeogenesis, glycogenesis, glycolysis, all those things. All right, so that's all really cool basic stuff that you have to know without a whole lot of detail, which is okay. You should have a nice flow of all of that. So what's the purpose of respiration? Yeah, to make ATP. Yeah, very good. Don't lose track of the overall purpose, okay, when you're learning the details. Okay, I got a sign-in sheet. Make sure everybody signs the sign-in sheet. Please. I guess I don't have a sign-in sheet. Okay, well, start a piece of paper around. Who's got a piece of paper? I can't use this one up. Yeah, I'll rip one out. Put today's... I've got one right up over here. Put today's date on it. Yeah. And Bio 241, and then pass it around, please. Okay, so autonomic nervous system. Now, does anybody have any questions, though, before we get started? Yes?
I have a question on chapter 5.
Okay, 5 is respiration.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
The question is, does the conversion of lactic acid to uric acid occur in the heart and the liver, or just the liver?
The conversion of
lactic acid to uric acid.
It occurs both in the heart and the liver.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Your answer in the book says just liver?
I'm just surprised it occurs in the heart also.
Yeah, lactic acid can be used as an energy source in the heart, as long as the heart is healthy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as long as it has oxygen.
Right.
Yeah, it can use lactate as a substrate. As long as it has oxygen present, then it can run gluconeogenesis. Yeah, it can make glucose out of lactate.
I have one more question.
Okay.
Is the maximum depolarization is usually 40 or 30?
Oh, I don't know if I give you a specific answer because every cell is going to be a little bit different, right?
Okay, so you don't expect us to know that.
No, that's too close a number. What would I expect you to know, like the difference between 2 and 30, for instance? But between what, 40 and 45, did you say? 40
no,
and 50?
One says 40 and the other one says 30. That was confusing.
Oh, yeah, that's too small a difference. I don't know of any physiologic importance for knowing that number between the different tissues, okay? Okay. That's a little bit too subtle. All right, so autonomic nervous system, just from anatomy, what is your autonomic nervous system control?
Heart.
Okay, the list is sounding good. Heart muscle, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and one other thing, glands. That's right. So as a matter of fact, there's really only one other effector organ in your body. There's really only four. You got smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, and what's the fourth one?
Skeletal
muscle. And what nervous system controls skeletal muscle? Yeah, that's your voluntary nervous system. Sometimes we call that the somatic nervous system. So somatic as opposed to autonomic nervous system. All right, so smooth muscle. So let's talk about one of these effector organs. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. A lot of smooth muscle can control its own activity depending on how much it is stressed or stretched. Smooth muscle becomes actually more sensitive when autonomic input is cut. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. So a lot of times, innervation to smooth muscle actually makes it what? More quiet. It keeps it quiescent. Many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active. We call that autorhythmic. They have their own rhythmicity. And the autonomic nervous system just increases or decreases that intrinsic rate of contraction in smooth muscle. Like, for instance, there is rhythmic smooth muscle in your digestive tract, which is moving food through your digestive tract. And that's actually kind of similar to cardiac muscle, because the heart does not need innervation either. The heart has its own intrinsic rhythm. A heart will beat on its own. Right? The autonomic nervous system can either speed it up or slow it down from whatever that intrinsic rate is. And we're going to look at different ion channels that describe how that happens and why that happens when we get to those particular chapters. Okay, so this slide right here just compares and contrasts two different pathways. One is a somatic motor pathway and another is an autonomic motor pathway. And in the somatic motor pathway, we see the cell body of the motor neuron in the ventral horn of the gray matter leaves the ventral root, right? And it gets into the spinal nerve, and it follows the spinal nerve to the effector organ, in this particular case, skeletal muscle, and it's going to cause that skeletal muscle to contract. So how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ for a voluntary pathway or a somatic motor pathway? It is just one. That's right. All right, so this is what we would call the lower motor neuron in this particular pathway. The upper motor neuron would be the one descending through the spinal cord. All right, in an autonomic pathway, we see that it is actually quite different. The cell body is in the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord, and then it leaves through the same way through the ventral root. And as on this slide here, we do see the dorsal root, but what kind of traffic is carried by the dorsal root it's 100% sensory, and the ventral root is 100% motor, so that's why I didn't really talk about the sensory neuron right here. All right, and then the cell goes out, joins the spinal nerve, and so this is sympathetic outflow, but the sympathetic nerve doesn't follow the ventral ramus to the rest of the body, or the dorsal ramus for that matter. It has to enter these little auxiliary spinal cords just for sympathetic activity. We call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. So these lie on either side of the vertebral column, and these are for 100% sympathetic activity or sympathetic outflow. So the sympathetic neuron enters, and it might synapse, right? And this ganglion right here, remember, a ganglion is a collection of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system someplace, so there might be thousands of these nerve cell bodies. And since there's a nerve cell body right here, what does it show us about this area? This is an actual, that's a synapse, right? Because these two cells need to communicate with each other. Right, so here is a second neuron then that takes that sympathetic signal to an effector organ, which would be what? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or glands. So a typical sympathetic, or actually any autonomic pathway, is going to need two neurons back to back to get to the effector organ, as opposed to somatic, it is just a single neuron. And since it takes two, and we have a ganglion in between, this first neuron is what we call the preganglionic neuron, and the second one is what we call the postganglionic neuron, right? So you might want to call it presynaptic or postsynaptic, but we don't because of this ganglion right here. Furthermore, sympathetic activity, once it gets into the sympathetic chain, right, if it synapses, it can leave and go back into the ventral ramus and go to some part of the body, or it can arise through the sympathetic chain to go up a number of levels, or it can descend through the sympathetic chain to go down a number of levels, or it can even pass right through the sympathetic chain to go to another ganglion someplace, which we call the prevertebral ganglia, or sometimes the collateral ganglia. So maybe some of this is ringing a bell for you. The nerve that connects the sympathetic chain with a collateral ganglion someplace is always going to be a splanchnic nerve, and there are different names of splanchnic nerves. Basically, there are three major splanchnic nerves, but splanchnic nerve is used a lot, and that just connects the sympathetic chain with the collateral ganglia someplace, or prevertebral ganglia. All right. The other thing that maybe I would talk about on this particular slide is that there is a big difference between the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fiber. We're going to see in a number of different ways, and one is myelination. Can anybody remember anything about the state of myelination between the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fiber? Back from anatomy? Ooh, when did you guys have anatomy? Not too long ago. What is the, oh yeah, maybe in the fall. That's not too long. All right. Well, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. The postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. All right, so you should know what that means in terms of speed of conduction already. So this right here, this rami communicante is between the spinal nerve and the sympathetic chain. If this is a myelinated fiber, what is that? What color does that look like? White or gray? That's white. So this is the white ramus communicantes. And if there's a postganglionic fiber re-entering the spinal nerve through this pathway right here, that would be the gray ramus communicantes. So notice how this kind of makes a funny loop if there's a nerve entering and then leaving. Right. First, the preganglionic fiber passes by the first communicantes right here and actually enters the second one. And this picture is correct, but since this is a physiology book, they don't always get it correct. And I'll point out the slide where they don't have it quite correct. All right, so somatic motor pathway, one. Autonomic motor pathways, got two, preganglionic and postganglionic fiber. Okay. And the cell bodies, you can see, are in different areas of the spinal cord. Autonomic would be the lateral horn. The somatic would be what, the ventral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. Okay. Divisions of the autonomic nervous system. What's the most important understanding, I think, that you can take away from this class? Is an appreciation of what?
ATP.
Is an appreciation of ATP. Don't forget, yes, the importance of ATP. That's really good. But of antagonism. Okay, antagonism, and that actually we covered that in your first lab, kind of pointed out how important it is to have antagonistic mechanisms. All right, so before you took this class, you probably thought antagonism is has what? Kind of a bad connotation to it. But in terms of control systems, what does that mean? Is it a good or bad thing? Excellent thing, right? Because, for instance, tell me once again, in your automobile, what are the two mechanisms that you need in order to drive your car? The gas and brake pedal, right? So these work in opposition to each other, and many systems in your body work in opposition to each other. The first thing probably you remember in the musculoskeletal system are you have muscles that are flexors, muscles that are extensors, and when they work together, you have precise control and balance over your body. Well, most parts of your body that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system also are operated by antagonistic nervous systems, and they're both divisions of the autonomic nervous system, and they're called what, the sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions. It's rare that they work in concert with each other. A couple circumstances we'll see that they actually work together, but in most cases they are antagonistic to each other, but the result is what? Precise control and balance. And when somebody is in a diseased state, the goal of medicine is to what? Reestablish that balance by properly adjusting these antagonistic mechanisms, whether it's a nervous system or endocrine system or musculoskeletal system or immune system, for instance. That's very important to do. So that's the understanding that eventually you'll get to. So these antagonistic divisions basically maintain homeostasis, which you wouldn't have a chance at maintaining otherwise. The sympathetic division mediates the fight and flight response or the stress response. The parasympathetic nervous system mediates the rest and repose or the rest and digest nervous system in your body, produces these effects. So for instance, if you're going to, who went and saw a movie over the weekend? Anybody have a chance? Oh, you're probably all studying like crazy. Aha, you don't want to incriminate yourselves. Okay. But if you want to see a movie, how much does it cost these days to go see a movie?
$11.
$11? Ooh, that's a really good price. You know, I'm thinking more like $50 if you got to pay for parking, you know, and sitter and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it could even be $100. So if you're going to pay $50 or $100 to go see a movie, what kind of movie are you going to see? One that stimulates the fight and flight response or the rest and digest response in you? Okay, you might say, oh, well, I'm ready for rest and digest. Okay, but, right, if you go see a movie that stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system, what's it going to do? It's going to make you fall asleep. Right, so there's no way you would pay to go see a movie of that kind. Right? You want to go see a movie that does what to you? Dilates your pupils big. What does it do to your respiratory rate? Increases your respiratory rate. What about perspiration? Yeah, if you start sweating, that's even better. What about your heart rate? Your heart pounding outside your chest, right? So you go definitely to go see those movies that stimulate your sympathetic nervous system, not your parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's just a little foreshadowing about what these things do in our body. All right, so the sympathetic division is what we call the thoracolumbar division. Signals can only leave through the levels between T1 and L2. Nowhere else, not through any cervical nerves, not through any cranial nerves, not through any sacral nerves. And so these signals leave through the intervertebral foramina via the ventral root, and then they have to enter the sympathetic chain ganglia, like we just mentioned right here, where they might synapse on the postganglionic fiber. So sometimes we call these the paravertebral ganglia because they're on either side of the spinal cord. But don't forget, sometimes there are ganglia that are in front of the vertebral column, and we call these the prevertebral ganglia, and then they're going to be connected via that splanchnic nerve. Okay. And then here are the different communicantes. Here's the white one, here's the gray one. All right, so this only happens from T1 to L2, or sympathetic as thoracolumbar. All right, the sympathetic nervous system operates pretty much as a unit. Once the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, it activates everything. It activates glands, it activates smooth muscle, activates cardiac muscle, and sometimes we call that mass activation. And this is the result of divergent and convergent pathways all working together. All right, so these are different kinds of pathways. So where would we see divergent circuits? So what is this fiber right here that's coming out the ventral root? How would we talk about this nerve fiber? This is the preganglionic fiber. This is the myelinated one. Right, and you should see it going in it's going in the gray ramus, so it's kind of not drawn properly, but it goes into the sympathetic chain. Does everybody see the slide is kind of drawn just a little bit wrong? But anyway, this fiber enters the sympathetic chain, and what happens to it? You see it, do I see a synapse right here? Oh, I see a synapse here. Yeah, it synapses here, so it can actually leave at the same level, but what else is happening? This is all one nerve fiber right here. It's bifurcating, right? So it bifurcates and it arises a couple levels through the sympathetic chain. And that bifurcation, it can also descend a couple levels, or it can even pass right through to the splanchnic nerve to stimulate a collateral ganglion someplace. So what happens to that signal? It gets split up and goes all over the place, right? So that's one characteristic of the sympathetic nervous system, that divergence of signal. And you can see it even descending even down further right here, right before it synapses on the postganglionic fiber. All right, something else too, I just switched slides on you, convergence. What do we see with these nerves, that single neuron that's bifurcated, that's moving through two different splanchnic nerves before it gets to this collateral ganglia? So that's what we call convergence of this signal. So these signals are split and then added back up again together. All right, so that's going to stimulate this postganglionic sympathetic fiber here to the digestive tract, okay, in a very large way. So sympathetic nervous system spreads the signal out pretty much everywhere in the body, right? It's not very selective, as opposed to the parasympathetic nervous system is much more selective in which autonomic effector organs it goes to. All right, it's not characterized by convergence and divergence or mass activation. And here we can see some of the prevertebral ganglia or collateral ganglia. Here is the sympathetic chain. And what's the name of that nerve fiber that's going to allow a sympathetic nerve to pass right through the sympathetic chain and go to a collateral ganglion someplace? That's what we call a splanchnic nerve, right? Just generally splanchnic. They all have different specific names depending on what level they're at, but you should at least know that they're a splanchnic nerve. All right, and then, so that's all the preganglionic fiber, and then from the collateral ganglia to the effector organ, that would be the postganglionic fiber. right? There is one track right here that I want you to pay attention to, and that is this organ right here. What does that look like to you? That's the adrenal gland. And the adrenal gland is kind of complex because there's a medulla and a cortex. What part is the medulla? That's the deep part, right? Using the proper anatomical language, that's the deep part. And we can see sympathetic fibers going into the adrenal gland. And these are actually the preganglionic fibers. They synapse on cells of the adrenal medulla. And the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fibers in all other parts of the sympathetic nervous system. All right, and when those cells depolarize, they just so happen to be called chromaffin cells. But when the chromaffin cells depolarize, they don't transmit electrical impulses anywhere. They just automatically release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the circulation, right? Which is another way to mass activate your sympathetic nervous system all over your body, because where does norepinephrine and epinephrine go once it's released from the adrenal medulla? It goes into the bloodstream, and then where? All over your body, affecting sympathetic activity everywhere in your body that your circulatory system goes to. All right, so here is an exception to the preganglionic / postganglionic fiber, and that means what? That means that the adrenal system, the sympathetic adrenal system, only has a preganglionic fiber going to it, and the chromaffin cells are actually acting like the postganglionic cell that you find everywhere else in your body. Okay. All right, so adrenal medulla located in the adrenal gland, yeah, that's superior to the kidney. Right, and that appears to be a modified collateral ganglia, and the adrenal gland doesn't transmit electrical impulses. As soon as it depolarizes, it releases epinephrine and norepinephrine. So epinephrine is a metabolite of norepinephrine. They can be interconverted. The adrenal medulla releases 85% epinephrine and only 15% norepinephrine. All right, so when you heard this term norepinephrine, what kind of signaling molecule would you think norepinephrine is? Okay. But for instance, when it's released from a neuron, you would think that it would be a neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, and this is what I think you're thinking ahead just a little bit, in this particular case, how is norepinephrine working? It doesn't diffuse across the synapse, but it goes into the blood. Okay. So now, norepinephrine is acting like a hormone. So in one case, you know norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter, another case as a hormone. So the proper term for norepinephrine is really what? It is a neurohormone, right? So depending on the circumstance, it either acts as a hormone or a neurotransmitter depending on the anatomy that it's being released from. All right, and so that adrenal activity contributes to mass activation of all sympathetics in your body, right? Because it goes everywhere in your body. So in a lot of classes, we don't break down the endocrine system and study the endocrine system and then study the nervous system, because there are a number of places in your body where they are linked together, like here at the adrenal medulla, and so it's really what? It's really the neuroendocrine system. So a lot of times we study both of those systems together because they interface so well. All right, so this just shows you the metabolic pathway that converts tyrosine into norepinephrine and epinephrine. One of the intermediates right here is DOPA, right? And that gets converted into dopamine. You don't have to memorize these structures, but you can see the only difference between norepinephrine and epinephrine right here is just this one little methyl group. All right, so how do you explain, let me go back to this one right here. So the adrenal medulla is releasing epinephrine and norepinephrine. How is it that these compounds right here can cause a response in some tissue in your body? Okay, because those tissues that are far from the adrenal medulla have to have a receptor for norepinephrine or epinephrine. And how do we describe the binding of a ligand to a receptor? Is it by the color or the vibration? Shape, right? It's by the shape. And you can see, what about the shape between norepinephrine and epinephrine right here? Pretty doggone similar, right? So they can bind to similar kinds of receptors. And it just so happens we would call those adrenergic receptors, right, if they bind norepinephrine and epinephrine. Okay. This DOPA right here, you can see, how would we talk about DOPA compared to dopamine? Dopamine is another neurotransmitter involved in control of the musculoskeletal system. Okay. How would you talk about DOPA? DOPA is actually a precursor to these different neurotransmitters right here. So, for instance, if someone was deficient in producing dopamine or norepinephrine or norepinephrine, okay, it might seem logical to give somebody a precursor to these neurotransmitters to boost up the levels. All right, and this actually is, this is how Parkinson's disease has tried to be treated, by giving a certain form of DOPA to people to work as a precursor to enhance the levels of dopamine. Or even stem cell transplants, like a brain transplant. Give them cells that produce dopamine, and that might overcome some of the repression of these dopaminergic or norepinephrine pathways that they have in their brain. Okay, so that would be, for instance, using stem cells to do that. All right, the parasympathetic division is a lot different than the sympathetic in terms of its neuroanatomy. It's what we call craniosacral outflow. All right, so motor activity can only leave the central nervous system via cranial nerves and sacral nerves. What's an important cranial nerve that carries parasympathetic outflow? The vagus. Which one is that? That's number 10, as a matter of fact. Okay, and then S2 through S4. Now how many nerves does it take for an autonomic pathway to get to an effector organ? It takes two. Same thing for parasympathetic nervous system. All right, but in this particular case, the ganglia are right on the effector organ. They're not on either side of the spinal cord. So in the parasympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fiber is relatively long, and the postganglionic fiber is microscopic. It's very, very small. So postganglionics have very short axons that innervate the target organ. Okay, there's one nerve that's really long, and that's the vagus, right? That's coming from cranial nerve number 10. And you can see it wandering around everywhere in the body. And that's exactly how they named this particular nerve, because way back when, people that wandered around in the world were called vagabonds. All right, so the vagus kind of wanders around all over the place. Okay. All right, so here's a slide that kind of puts the neuroanatomy all together. What kind of outflow is thoracolumbar? What kind of outflow is thoracolumbar? That is sympathetic, and indeed, if you look, we see all of these fibers go into the sympathetic chain. So how would you talk about these nerve fibers right here? These are the preganglionic fibers. All right, so all of the solid lines on this diagram are preganglionic fibers. All of the dotted lines are postganglionic fibers, right? And you can see that, for instance, this nerve right here synapses in the sympathetic chain, because what's leaving? The postganglionic fiber going to some effector organ, like, for instance, the heart. And here is, what kind of fiber is this right here? Is this preganglionic or postganglionic? It's preganglionic. You see it passing right through the sympathetic chain on its way to a prevertebral ganglia. What do we call a nerve fiber that connects the sympathetic chain with a prevertebral ganglia? That's a splanchnic nerve, and it's probably labeled splanchnic someplace. Yeah, that would be the greater splanchnic in this region right here. And then in the prevertebral ganglia, we see that it synapses on the postganglionic fiber, which then takes it to a particular effector organ. So we got two kinds of ganglia in the sympathetic nervous system. All right, let's look at the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the blue right here. And can you tell that the preganglionic nerves are really much longer? They go all the way to the target tissue. And as a matter of fact, here in the lung, here's the postganglionic fiber. What can you tell me about the length of the postganglionic fiber? Really, really short. Okay, and as a matter of fact, in some places on this slide, I can't even see it. Like on the heart right here, I can't even see it because they are so short. Maybe right here on the uterus, I can see one. Okay, so that's kind of what you should know about comparing and contrasting the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. This table right here kind of underscores the antagonism between the two divisions, which is what? A good thing, right? In order to have precise control and balance of your body. So, for instance, in the eye, sympathetic innervation causes pupil dilation, but the parasympathetic causes constriction. And when those are in balance, your eye can adjust properly for the ambient light conditions. What is it protecting? By relaxing or constricting your iris. It's protecting your retina from too much light, right? In order, actually, it allows you to see things, which means it helps you from bumping into things, right? Okay. All right, so we'll look at these two different muscles when we get into the senses chapter. Let's see, what else is a good one? Let's go to the heart. Oh, here, adrenal gland. Adrenal gland, this is sort of interesting. The adrenal gland has only innervation from the sympathetic nervous system. The parasympathetic nervous system doesn't even go there. So there is no antagonism over the release of what from the adrenal medulla? What's released from the adrenal medulla again? Yeah, norepinephrine and epinephrine. Primarily epinephrine, right? 80% epinephrine. All right, now, autonomic innervation of the heart. How about strength of, rate. Let's look at rate. Heart rate. Sympathetic increases heart rate. Parasympathetic decreases heart rate. Let's look at something else. Let's look at the motility of the gastrointestinal tract. So in terms of the heart rate, what is stimulatory and what is inhibitory? What nervous system is stimulatory to heart rate? It's the sympathetic nervous system, okay? All right, well, you just can't say in every particular case that the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory or stimulatory. You have to know by individual case. The only thing you know for sure in most cases that if the sympathetic is stimulatory, the parasympathetic is inhibitory. But it might flip on you depending on the organ system that you're looking at. All right, so the easiest questions are, well, if the sympathetic is stimulatory, what is the parasympathetic on some part of your body? It's going to be inhibitory, right? That would be the easiest kind of connection to make. So, for instance, in the gastrointestinal tract, in terms of motility, which is what, moving material through your digestive tract, it is inhibited by the sympathetic nervous system, which is what, the opposite effect on the heart. And what would you guess for parasympathetic nervous system? It is stimulatory, okay? Because remember, what nervous system stimulates the digestive tract? You have the fight or flight or the rest and digest nervous system, which is what, the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So a good way to think of this, right, the parasympathetic versus the sympathetic nervous system is always in those two effects, which is going to put you into the fight or flight mode or which will put you into the rest and digest. So for instance, if you're presented with a life-threatening situation, do you need to be digesting food that you eat? Does blood need to go to your digestive system? No. Where does that blood, for instance, need to go?
Muscles.
It needs to go to muscles so that you can run or fly away, for instance, or whatever, fight. Right? It needs to go to your heart, your myocardium, because your heart rate is increasing. Okay? And should your pupils constrict?
No.
You should be able to see a lot of things, right? They're going to dilate. So always think in terms of the flight or fight response or the rest and digest or rest and repose to understand something about how the sympathetic nervous system is either going to be inhibitory or excitatory. Another good place to look, let's see if we can find lungs, bronchioles. Right? The sympathetic nervous system dilates. That means that it's going to inhibit the contraction of smooth muscle of bronchioles. Bronchioles are smooth. Our airways lined with smooth muscle. And when they dilate, what does that mean? Can you breathe more easily or less easily if they dilate?
More easily,
right? We're going to see how, I don't know if you've done a lab yet on Poiseuille's equation, but as a tube dilates, right? That increases the flow tremendously. So a little dilation of a bronchiole, you'll be able to increase aeration of your lungs dramatically. All right, but on the other hand, parasympathetic constricts the bronchioles, right? So when you're in a resting stage, you don't need to be hyperventilating. You don't really need to be moving a lot of air in and out of your lungs. So those bronchioles can constrict. Okay, here is an example, for instance, of how the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system can work in concert with each other, but in a little bit different ways. All right, so the sympathetic causes ejaculation, all right, but that only works when, okay, well, it doesn't have to work only when, but it works in concert with erection. All right, so these two, so parasympathetic and sympathetic are not antagonistic to each other, yes, in this case. Ah, okay, because erection is due to a vasodilation of blood vessels, so that the penis engorges with blood, and that's what causes an erection, when the penis fills with blood, and that's due to, what, relaxation of smooth muscle of the penis. Okay, and ejaculation is going to be contraction of smooth muscle of the vessels like the vas deferens and epididymis, for instance. And maybe muscles around the prostate gland and things like that. Okay. All right, so in a sense, if you look a little bit deeper, we can see that there's what? Inhibition of smooth muscle here and excitation of smooth muscle over in this particular case. Okay. All right, so by, you can't always say sympathetic is stimulatory because sometimes it is inhibitory, like on the digestive tract. Let me see, what about blood vessels? Blood vessels, mostly constrictors, right? So epinephrine and norepinephrine mostly causes constriction, right? But in a few, it causes dilation, in particular, for instance, muscle tissue. Because when you're in a fight or flight response, where does blood need to go? It needs to be taken from one part of your body where there's going to be vasoconstriction, and then given to other parts of your body where there's going to be vasodilation, so that those muscles, for instance, get plenty of oxygen and nutrients. Okay, so how could you describe, okay, why different tissues might have different responses to the autonomic nervous system? How is it that there could be vasoconstriction in one part of your body of a blood vessel, but vasodilation in another part? Yeah, the antagonistic effects of the autonomic nervous system. Okay? All right, I'm going to ask you sort of a corollary to that question in a little bit. Okay, neurotransmitters. Here is an exam figure, not for Wednesday, but for next time around, right, which will layer some information on, and maybe you know this already from anatomy, I'm not quite sure. All right, but here we see autonomic outflow. So is this sympathetic or parasympathetic right in this region right here? That's right. That's thoracolumbar outflow. And how do you know this is autonomic outflow and not somatic outflow? Because, yeah, you see a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. And the connection between them is what kind of synapse? Electrical or chemical synapse? It's a chemical synapse, which means it has to use a neurotransmitter, some kind of chemical to go across the synaptic cleft. And in each one of these cases right here, whether it is the sympathetic division or even the parasympathetic division, the neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine. So right here, this is what? Parasympathetic outflow in the cranial division. This is parasympathetic outflow in the sacral division. And between the preganglionic and postganglionic cell, the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine in every particular case. And how many different kinds of receptors did you learn about for acetylcholine? Okay, so far two. You learned about nicotinic and muscarinic. All right, and in every case on this postganglionic fiber right here, the receptor for acetylcholine is a nicotinic receptor. All right, so in every particular case, acetylcholine is going to produce EPSPs, right, in all of these ganglia, the sympathetic ganglia as well as the parasympathetic ganglia. is going to produce EPSPs. All right, now let's look at the postganglionic fiber. In the parasympathetic nervous system, all right, we see that it is acetylcholine. All right, and depending on the tissue, some of these, well, these are all muscarinic receptors, but in skeletal muscle, it's a nicotinic receptor, but we don't have a somatic neuron right here, but these are going to be stimulating muscarinic receptors. We're going to see that there's different kinds of muscarinic receptors. All right, but what is a neurotransmitter released from the sympathetic nervous system? The postganglionic fiber of the sympathetic nervous system. It is norepinephrine, right, norepinephrine, including the adrenal medulla is going to release some norepinephrine. That just, however, is going to end up in the circulatory system. All right, so all of the preganglionic fibers are what we call cholinergic fibers because they release acetylcholine, right? The postganglionic fibers in the parasympathetic nervous system are also called cholinergic because they release acetylcholine. Now, what about the postganglionic fibers of the sympathetic nervous system? They don't release acetylcholine, so we can't call those cholinergic fibers. These are what we call adrenergic fibers because they release, what, adrenaline or, noradrenaline, which is what, norepinephrine. And in the case of the adrenal medulla, it would be adrenaline, which is another name for epinephrine, right? Okay. So you make sure you know what neurotransmitters are used for the preganglionic fiber for each nervous system and the postganglionic fiber.
So on the synapse, they release...
Right here?
All of them release acetylcholine.
Everyone releases acetylcholine. Only the postganglionics are different. And this is a really interesting effect because we said these are all nicotinic receptors right here. All right. And why is it that when somebody smokes a cigarette and they get this big rush of nicotine in their body and that's going to act like acetylcholine, how come that doesn't screw up their autonomic nervous system immediately and causes fatality immediately? Why is it that somebody can even take nicotine into their body? As opposed to muscarin and other kinds of chemicals, which are almost immediately fatal. Why is that? The slide kind of shows it. Because what can you tell me about, for instance, the sympathetic outflow compared to the parasympathetic outflow? If we stimulate both of these the same amount, what's the overall effect on the body going to be? And why? Somebody said antagonist, right? So if we inject both of these pathways with the same kind of noise signal, like when you smoke a cigarette, what's the effect on your body going to be? They're going to cancel out. Okay? I mean, predominantly, there's going to be some sympathetic effects, but all right, because of the way the autonomic nervous system is set up, nicotine is not immediately fatal. But if it didn't work through an antagonistic nervous system, you'd have no chance, right, if you were to smoke a cigarette, for instance. Okay. Because it would control, overstimulate so many things in your body. Okay. Okay, neurotransmitter release compared to somatic, for instance, neuromuscular junction is quite a bit different. In the somatic nervous system, neurotransmitter is released only from the axon terminus or the bouton terminale or however you want to talk about the terminal button on an axon. But neurotransmitters are released through the whole length of an axon in an autonomic fiber. All right, so each one of these little enlargements right here is an area that contains synaptic vesicles, which get released when an action potential courses down the axon. So neurotransmitter is released, what, through the whole length of an axon, and not just at the axon terminus like for a somatic motor pathway. So sometimes we call these are what are called synapses in passant or synapses in passing, and these little swellings are what we call varicosities. So both the parasympathetic and sympathetic release neurotransmitters, all right, from these varicosities. And so here is acetylcholine being released. Now, what does this look like to you? This one is upside down. Let's look at this one right here. What kind of receptor does that look like to you?
It's
Yeah, G protein. Yeah, or muscarinic. So here's one that's upside down. That's a G protein for acetylcholine. That would be a muscarinic kind of receptor. All right, so you even saw that, I think, on your first test. That's why you kind of started looking at that right away. So these are all G protein coupled receptors that are utilized by the postganglionic fibers. Okay, but nonetheless, this is a cholinergic fiber because it releases acetylcholine. This is an adrenergic fiber because it releases norepinephrine. But it's mediated by these G protein coupled receptors. Okay, so let's just pay attention to adrenergic stimulation, which means what neurotransmitter is being released? Norepinephrine, right? Only norepinephrine, which is kind of the hallmark of what the sympathetic nervous system, right? The sympathetic nervous system. All right, so adrenergic stimulation, that means action potentials coming down adrenergic nerves, can cause either excitation or inhibition depending on the tissue. So the question would be, how is it that one signaling molecule can cause different effects in different parts of your body? It'd be a lot easier if there was just one signal, right? If, for instance, I were to say, hey, and you'd turn your head and say, what? But sometimes, hey means run away or something, right? How does your body know, right, that it should produce different effects in different tissues, even for the same signaling molecule? How would you, what would you invoke to explain that? How different effects can be produced by the same signaling molecule? Yeah, because different tissues might have different receptors. They might bind the same molecule, right? It's going to be a G protein coupled receptor, but through that mechanism, that the G protein might activate, for instance, a chloride channel, which is going to produce an IPSP, or it might open up a sodium channel, which is going to produce an EPSP. So one signaling molecule can have different effects in the body based on different receptors. Right, and who puts those receptors into the cell membrane in different tissues? Whose job is that? That's the job of the nucleus, right, to control the activity of the cell. So the nucleus knows what kind of receptors to put into the plasma membrane. Okay, so the adrenergic stimulation causes various effects in your body. And so we know that there are two major kinds of subtypes. There are alpha and beta adrenergic receptors. And furthermore, we even know that there are some subtypes of the major ones. There's alpha 1, alpha 2, there's beta 1 and beta 2. So these are the ones you got to be familiar with, not for the test on Wednesday, but for the next test. All right, here's some common ground. They're all G protein coupled receptors working through second messengers. All right, so you should say, okay, what's the first messenger? Where do you find the first messenger? Outside the cell, and it is norepinephrine. That's the first messenger. What might be a second messenger? I think maybe we talked about some. Cyclic AMP is one, and also calcium could be another second messenger. All right, that end up where? Inside the cell. All right, so all G protein coupled, oh, I said that. The beta, both beta 1 and beta 2, use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, and all of the alpha receptors use calcium as a second messenger system. So again, there's some organization to this structure right here. So let's look at some different effects that these different receptors produce. Okay, in the eye, contraction of radial fibers of the iris, right, the radial fiber, let me draw an iris. We'll look at this when we, sorry about that, we'll look at this when we get to the senses chapter. But here is, for instance, your iris right here. And what's that hole in the iris called? That's your pupil, okay? The radial fibers look like this, right? So they're attached to the iris, and when they contract, what happens to the pupil? It dilates due to contraction of these radial fibers, all right? We'll talk about the circular fibers a little bit later on. All right, so contraction does what? It dilates the pupil. So alpha 1 type receptors produce what kind of effect on the target tissue, at least according to this first case right here? Does it, yeah, it causes what? It stimulates the muscles to contract, right? Even though it causes dilation, it's causing these radial fibers to contract, so that's doing what? It's depolarizing. It's producing EPSPs on these fibers right here to contract. That's what an alpha 1 does. Okay, let's look at the heart. All right, and it primarily has beta 1 receptors. And what's the effect with these beta 1 receptors? Does it inhibit the heart or stimulate the heart? Increases heart rate and force of contraction. So beta 1 is also stimulatory. It causes excitation of cardiac muscle. All right, what about visceral blood vessels, skin? These arterioles, so think in terms of the fight and flight response. Fight and flight response. Do you need to have a lot of nutrients and oxygen going to your skin when you're faced with a life-threatening situation? No, you don't. And a way to cut off blood supply is to vasoconstrict those blood vessels so that the blood has the chance to go to muscle that you'll be using under that circumstance. So a good receptor for that is one that is, what, stimulatory. Where did we see stimulatory before? Alpha 1, okay, for the radial fiber. So alpha 1 are stimulatory. Okay, other kinds, for instance, in skeletal muscle, arterioles dilate due to mass activation from the adrenal gland, mostly due to epinephrine, right? But if that causes dilation, that is inhibiting the smooth muscle of blood vessels, causing them to dilate. When they dilate, that can carry a lot more blood, right? So the body can't use a beta 1 because that's going to be stimulatory. That uses a beta 2 receptor. All right, let's talk about beta 2 some more. In terms of the lungs, when you're in a fight or flight response, you want your bronchioles to be constricted, hard to breathe, or dilated so it's easy to breathe? Dilated, so you need to inhibit that smooth muscle of bronchioles, causing them to dilate. And what kind of receptor type is inhibitory? Yeah, the B2, right, the beta 2. Just like for skeletal muscle. Okay, these others probably aren't quite so important, but for instance, sphincters, which act as gates or valves between different parts of your intestinal tract, those are stimulated to close, and that kind of shuts down your digestive tract under stressful situations, right? So what kind of receptor is stimulatory? It is the alpha 1, right? I can't see it on the screen, but that should look like an alpha 1. Does it look like alpha 1 to you? Okay. All right, and then also sympathetic activity in the liver causes an increased secretion of glucose. You know, I probably won't ever mention this to you. Alpha 1 and beta 2. All right, so what is one way that you can kind of remember this right here? In terms of stimulation of the heart during a flight or fight response, okay, is it going to be stimulatory on the heart or inhibitory? Okay, and you just got to memorize it's a beta kind of receptor. And how many hearts do you have?
One.
All right, so it's a beta 1 that's stimulatory. Now, under the same circumstances, what about breathing? Should the bronchioles constrict or dilate? And how many lungs do you have? You got two. So just kind of link it up. Beta 1 on the heart, beta 2 on the lungs, right? And they're going to have opposite effects, but you got to key on the mechanism, right? The fight or flight mechanism to understand how your body might want to respond to that. So that might help you memorize this table a little bit here. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let me track along with you here. So we're talking about beta 2.
Yeah. On the
okay.
Dilating due to
hormones. Okay. So we're talking skeletal muscle. Okay. And that's going to increase blood flow. So that's going to inhibit, all right, the smooth muscle of arterioles feeding skeletal muscle, because when you're in a fight or flight response, those skeletal muscles need a lot of nutrients and oxygen to perform for you. Okay, it wouldn't do you any good to vasoconstrict blood vessels to skeletal muscle, because what would happen? Your muscles would fatigue or cramp up or something, and that wouldn't be helpful at all. Okay. Okay, yeah. Beta 2 is inhibitory. It causes dilation. Yep. It inhibits smooth muscle. It relaxes smooth muscle. Beta 2s relax smooth muscle. But you don't have beta 2s all over your body. Where's a good place for you to have beta 2 receptors?
Heart.
Not heart.
Lungs.
Right, bronchioles, smooth muscle of bronchioles. Smooth muscle of arterioles, specifically going to skeletal muscle when you need to operate under stressful circumstances. Okay? Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, I kind of missed it, where your skeletal muscles, they both constrict and dilate with alpha-1 and beta-2?
Well, you know what? I think the predominant effect that I would want for you to know is beta-2. Okay, skeletal muscles, because that matches up best with a fight or flight response. Okay, so skeletal muscle, just know that they have beta-2 that's going to be, when the beta-2 is stimulated, that causes inhibition of the smooth muscle, so you have increased perfusion of blood to skeletal muscle capillary beds when you start to exercise. More blood goes there in a really big way. And we'll see why it's a really big way in a little bit. Dang, have I been talking really fast? I don't, how many slides are left? Oh, a couple. Okay. All right, so here is another exam figure. This will help you kind of remember those different receptors and what their effects are on the body. And so what could you tell me about this nervous system right here? Is it autonomic or is it somatic? It's autonomic. Okay, why did you say that? Now here's the real test. Because why? Because there are two neurons. There's a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. So you know it's some kind of autonomic outflow. And here we see in every particular case, what is this neurotransmitter at the ganglion? It's going to be acetylcholine. So every single preganglionic neuron is what? A cholinergic fiber. And every receptor on these dendrites right here is going to be what we call a nicotinic receptor. So what is being produced by acetylcholine on all of these cell bodies and dendrites right here? EPSPs or IPSPs? EPSPs, because they're always a nicotinic receptor. Okay, the postganglionic fiber, only for the sympathetic nervous system, releases acetylcholine. You might find an exception to that in a couple places of the body, but let's not get concerned with that. Let's just say that for the parasympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine. So this is also a cholinergic fiber, right? All right, now for the sympathetic nervous system, we see norepinephrine being released in every particular case. So these postganglionics are adrenergic fibers. And in every particular case, the receptors, right, for acetylcholine and norepinephrine are going to be G-protein-coupled receptors for autonomic outflow. Right, they're all G-protein coupled receptors. There's only one effector organ that has a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. Can anybody remember which one that is? That's not on this slide because this is autonomic outflow, but for somatic outflow, what is the other effector organ? That's skeletal muscle. And skeletal muscles have nicotinic receptors. So anytime you put acetylcholine on a skeletal muscle, what's going to be produced? A massive EPSP, right? Massive depolarization, which in every case is going to cause contraction as a result of that, okay? Because there are nicotinic receptors on skeletal muscle, but not so for visceral organs, okay? Like your heart, for instance. Okay, so these G-protein-coupled receptors are called muscarinic receptors in the parasympathetic nervous system, and sometimes these might be stimulatory, they might be inhibitory, depending on the exact nature of that muscarinic receptor. Just like for the adrenergic receptors, right? How many adrenergic receptors did you know about so far? There are four, right? There's alpha-1, alpha-2, beta-1, beta-2. We didn't talk about the alpha-2s, and I probably won't talk about alpha-2s. They're in your brain, and their effects are, well, to me, it's a little nebulous what they do. Maybe somebody is an expert and knows exactly a lot about alpha-2s in the brain, but they can be used to control blood pressure, which might have an inhibitory effect on smooth muscle and blood vessels, okay? But it's not clear to me, so it's something you're going to have to learn somewhere else, okay? But clinically, alpha-2 agonists are used clinically. But what I want you to know are the alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2 kinds of receptors. All right, so when norepinephrine stimulates an alpha 1, okay, can you recall kind of what was that? What was happening there? Is it stimulatory or inhibitory? Alpha 1s are stimulatory on smooth muscle, right? Okay, so it causes vasoconstriction of the skin and viscera, like digestive organs in your body, because you don't need those things during the fight or flight response. Okay, beta 1, adrenergic receptors. These are found in the heart during the fight or flight response. What should happen to your heart rate? It should increase, right? So beta 1s are excitatory. They increase heart rate as well as force a contraction. Did you ever drive down the freeway or something and you're just paying attention, minding your own business, and then all of a sudden a semi tractor trailer starts to move over and cut you off, and another one comes from the other side, and it looks like there's no way at all to get out of an accident, and you think you're going to get crushed? Has anybody ever experienced that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What happens to your heart? Under those circumstances, you're sure you're going to die. What happens to your heart? Oh, it starts like pounding out of your chest, right? Because that is a massive sympathetic outflow. Your adrenal gland has squished out a lot of norepinephrine and norepinephrine. And how long does it take you to get over that effect even? A while, because not only are you under the influence of those neurotransmitters, but also those neurohormones, they have a longer duration of action. All right, so you might be shaky for hours after an episode like that. All right, that's due to the stimulation of those beta 1 receptors on your heart. All right, at that same time, your bronchioles are going to dilate. That is due to the beta 2 receptors. That's going to inhibit smooth muscle of the lungs so that you can increase your inhalation or your ventilation of your lungs. Okay. All right, so this is a good little table right here to remember. Some people have an easier time remembering these receptors in a tabular form. I have a real easy time when I see a graphic like this. So this is something that you just have to memorize, because this right here is an exam figure, for instance. Okay. Okay. Cholinergic stimulation, which means what neurotransmitter is used? Acetylcholine, right, is used at all neuromuscular junctions, right, on skeletal muscle, all preganglionic fibers and parasympathetic postganglionic fibers. And there are a couple types. You have nicotinic and muscarinic. Nicotinic can also be, it's stimulated by nicotine that's a plant alkaloid, and it can be inhibited or blocked by curare. So curare has kind of the same shape as acetylcholine and nicotine. It can bind to the nicotinic receptors and block them so that nicotine doesn't bind, and then that receptor system doesn't work. Right? So that was used by Aboriginal peoples in South America because they could hunt big game. There's no water buffalo, I don't think, in South America, but let's just say there were. Okay. If you were a guy, you could hunt water buffalo, huge game, with just a little tiny arrow, a little dart, because what did they learn how to do? They learned to find curare and then cover, coat the tips of these little tiny arrows into the big game and shoot it into the big game. And then curare would block the nicotinic receptors, and what would happen to this big animal?
Paralysis.
Yeah, paralysis. Okay, specifically, like, where do you have nicotinic receptors? Skeletal muscle, okay. What kind of muscle is a diaphragm?
Skeletal.
That's skeletal muscle. So how far can you run if you can't breathe? Not very far, right? So you didn't need these big, huge, right, armaments to hunt incredibly big game because you had this, like, nuclear-tipped little warhead, okay, namely curare. All right, muscarinic receptors are stimulated by a compound that is produced by fungi. That's muscarin. All right, and found in poisonous mushrooms, and that blocks muscarinic receptors. Does your sympathetic nervous system use muscarinic receptors?
No,
because it's always adrenergic. So if you stimulate, all right, and block only the parasympathetic nervous system, all right, that causes big problems because it's not being balanced out by any kind of sympathetic activity. All right, and these can be blocked by atropine. So atropine can be used as an antidote to muscarinic type of poisons, you know, like for instance nerve gas and things like that, which will that will bind and poison muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. Question? No. Okay, so here is, you've been looking at this, I think. Did I put this on Blackboard?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the dreaded day has come where you have to know something about these receptors, but now you're kind of familiar with these things already, because when you look at these, what do you see right here? You see just a simple ligand-gated channel, okay, and this is a nice nicotinic type, so when it binds to acetylcholines, it changes conformation, it opens up, the predominant, it's patent for both sodium and potassium, but the primary effect is what? Motion of sodium entering the cell causing depolarization, or how would you consider that? That would be an EPSP, right? That would be an excitatory, producing excitation. Exactly right. Okay, muscarinic kinds of receptors work through G protein coupled kinds of receptors, and we said that sometimes they are excitatory or sometimes they are inhibitory. And now you can probably think in your mind a mechanism of how that might work. So let's take a look. Here is the receptor molecule. It only has to bind one acetylcholine signaling molecule. That activates the G protein, which floats around inside the membrane. And remember, it dissociates into either that alpha unit or the beta gamma subunit. When it bumps into a second protein in the membrane, it might activate it. All right. In this particular case, it might bump into a potassium channel, causing it to open. If it opens a potassium channel, what's going to happen? Hyperpolarization. This cell moves farther away from threshold. That inhibits the cell, right? So this kind of muscarinic receptor causes inhibition. All right, and that's going to, for instance, slow the heart rate because that hyperpolarizes the cells of the heart. That's going to slow the heart rate down. So when we get to the cardiac chapter, you'll see even a little bit more with this receptor right here. Or on the other hand, you can have a G protein coupled receptor when acetylcholine binds to it, right? And the G protein bumps into a potassium channel. It might actually close one that is open. So if there's one that's open, what is it causing for the cell when it's at rest? When it's open, it's causing, it's maintaining, right, that hyperpolarized state. But when you close it, what's going to happen to it? It's going to become more positive. It's going to be more positive inside the cell. And so that's going to depolarize the cell, making it more easily to reach threshold. Or, for instance, maybe instead of closing this potassium channel, the G protein will bump into a sodium or calcium channel, causing it to open. And when a sodium or calcium channel opens, what happens? Depolarization inside the cell, that's going to produce an EPSP. So either closing the potassium or opening up a sodium is going to produce EPSPs, excitatory potentials inside the cell. So that's what we call excitation. All right, so that happens in smooth muscles of the, for instance, arterioles, all right, and the digestive tract. Okay, so one kind of signaling molecule, namely acetylcholine, can have different effects, either inhibition or excitation, because of different receptors that it stimulates. Right, so that's how we can explain how one neurotransmitter can have different effects in the body in different tissues, because those tissues put in different kinds of receptor complexes. Okay, so here are some different kinds of cholinergic receptors and the response to acetylcholine. Just like for adrenergic receptors, cholinergic receptors can have different responses. All right, well, nicotinic is always going to be what? Excitatory. All right, so it's going to cause depolarization. Opens cation channels of some kind. And sodium would be a good example of that. All right, and nicotinic you find in all skeletal muscle and all autonomic ganglia between the what? The preganglionic fiber and postganglionic fiber are nicotinic. Smooth muscles and glands are excited when they have the M3 and M5 subtypes that causes depolarization. Acetylcholine activates G protein coupled receptor opening calcium channels, increasing cytosolic calcium, which causes what? Depolarization. All right. In the heart, on the other hand, there is type 2 muscarinic receptor. Unfortunately, it doesn't match up very well with beta receptors. What kind of beta receptor does the heart have? Beta 1. I wish they would have named it M1, but they didn't. Okay, because it wasn't the first one that they discovered, unfortunately. All right, that's an M2 in the heart that causes hyperpolarization because it activates G proteins, which open potassium channels. And as a result, that's going to slow the heart rate down. Okay, so muscarinic receptors can be stimulatory or inhibitory depending on which channels are activated in different kinds of tissues. All right, so that's it for this particular lecture. All right, so we still got 10 minutes left. So I guess I should ask you some questions. Oh, you want to ask me questions first?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought I could get out of answering questions. But anyway, that's okay.
So the GABA and glycine, those are nicotinic receptors, yeah?
Oh, they're GABA and glycine receptors. So they don't work through acetylcholine at all. Yeah, so they're receptors that respond specifically to the shape of GABA and the shape of glycine. Yeah.
Are they inhibitory and excitatory depending on what they're binding to?
No. No, they're pretty strictly one or the other.
But these work kind of like the nicotinic receptors, right? Because they have a little ion channel in the picture.
Let's see. The GABA, I think, act kind of like a nicotinic receptor.
Yeah.
And the glycine might be a G protein. I can't remember. Yeah. I can't remember how that one necessarily works, but when you get to a point where you might want to learn more about them, a little bit of study, you should probably be able to pick it up pretty quick.
And is there a name for the receptor that when norepinephrine binds to a receptor and uses G protein and converts it into
a... We just call it... the one that uses cyclic AMP is what? The alpha type.
Yeah.
And the one that's a calcium is a beta type. But they're all G-protein coupled receptors.
Okay.
So the most kind of receptors you have in your body really are the G-protein kind of receptors, and those are the ancient form that's used by most organisms on our planet. Okay?
So the G-protein receptors are the most common type?
It's the most highly conserved. The ligand-gated channels are kind of a new invention in biology. All right, so next time, yes, question. Relative refractory period is due to potassium channels that are open that are slowly closing. And as they slowly close, that relative refractory period slowly goes away. Okay? Yeah, that's the best way to think of that one. Yeah, so you got to have some nice practice for that test. And probably really key to doing well on these tests is work the figures. The figures, you know, one figure is worth a million words. So if you understand those figures, you probably do pretty well on even the multiple choice. And you can even use the figures on the test to answer the multiple choice questions if you can label them properly. Okay. All right, so you need good Scantron 882, even better eraser, pencil, and you know what? I don't think you need a calculator for this test. You don't need a calculator for this. Yeah, I need your ID again. So that's just kind of like blanket statement. Every student, every test, no matter what. And next semester, I'm going to make it a Cypress College picture ID. So I think this semester, I'm kind of looking at any kind of picture ID, but next time I'll even make it a Cypress College picture ID. Oh, somebody left this in lab? Was this last week? Okay. Wednesday. Somebody left this in lab. Oh, yeah. Okay. As soon as I turn my microphone off, I know who it is. Your name is in here. But I don't want to say it for the internet who it is. And I don't know this person. So anybody else have a question? I'm going to turn my microphone off.